Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, August 14, 2025, we talk about overweight, obesity, and diabetes, lactated Ringer solution versus normal saline, and spinal muscular atrophy, a review article on metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, a case report of a woman with respiratory failure and abnormal chest imaging, and perspectives on dismantling public health infrastructure, on progress lost, on private law in American healthcare, and on the serendipitous dance between life and death. Co-administered cagrilintide and semaglutide in adults with overweight or obesity, by W. Timothy Garvey, from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and co-authors. Semaglutide, at a dose of 2.4 milligrams, has established weight loss and cardiovascular benefits, and cagrilintide, at a dose of 2.4 milligrams, has shown promising results in early phase trials. This Phase 3a study evaluated the efficacy of the combination on weight loss in persons with either overweight and coexisting conditions or obesity. 3,417 participants underwent randomization, with 2,108 assigned to receive cagrilintide semaglutide, 302 to receive semaglutide alone, 302 to receive cagrilintide alone, and 705 to receive placebo. The combination of cagrilintide-semaglutide provided significant body weight reductions in adults with overweight or obesity as compared with placebo. Gastrointestinal adverse events affected 80% of those in the cagrilintide-semaglutide group compared with 40% in the placebo group. Cagrilintide semaglutide in adults with overweight or obesity and type 2 diabetes, by Melanie Davies, from the University of Leicester, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Data are needed on the co-administration of cagrilintide and semaglutide for weight management in adults with type 2 diabetes, including those in a subgroup who are undergoing continuous glucose monitoring. In this Phase 3a trial, 1,206 patients with obesity and type 2 diabetes were randomly assigned in a 3-to-1 ratio to receive once-weekly cagrilintide semaglutide or placebo, along with lifestyle intervention, for 68 weeks. Once-weekly cagrilintide semaglutide resulted in a significantly lower body weight than placebo in adults with obesity and type 2 diabetes. Gastrointestinal adverse events were reported by 73% of the patients in the cagrilintide semaglutide group and 34% in the placebo group, most of which were transient and mild or moderate in severity. Craig Hales, from the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland, writes in an editorial that cagrilintide semaglutide, if approved by the Food and Drug Administration, would offer an additional option for individualized treatment of obesity and overweight with comorbidities. Dose adjustment also allows flexibility in reaching individualized health targets while managing side effects, which, as these two trials showed, is possible at less than maximum doses. Implementation of a treat-to-target approach for persons with obesity and overweight is complicated by the lack of an established target. Treating to the target BMI of 25 is not necessarily appropriate for every patient, for example, in older adults for whom loss of muscle mass and bone is particularly worrisome. A sustainable treat-to-target approach should extend to lifelong maintenance of health gains after initial weight loss. The intensity and composition of lifestyle interventions in the context of highly effective pharmacologic therapies also need further study. The pharmaceutical pipeline is promising, with potential improvements in safety, such as preservation of lean mass, and more convenience for patients, such as oral administration and monthly dosing. Greater effects on the health of Americans may be achieved not with anti-obesity medications producing ever greater magnitudes of weight loss, but with expanded access to safe and effective therapies for those who would most benefit. A crossover trial of hospital-wide lactated Ringer's solution versus normal saline by Laura Lynn McIntyre from the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute, Canada, and co-authors. Whether lactated Ringer's solution is clinically superior to normal saline for routine intravenous administration of fluids is uncertain. In this cluster randomized crossover trial, hospitals in Ontario, Canada were assigned to use either lactated Ringer's solution or normal saline hospital-wide for a period of 12 weeks. After a washout period, hospitals switched to the other fluid for 12 weeks. The primary outcome was a composite of death or readmission to the hospital within 90 days after the index admission. 7 hospitals completed both 12-week periods before the trial was interrupted, owing to the COVID-19 pandemic. A hospital-wide policy to administer lactated Ringer's solution rather than normal saline did not result in a significantly lower incidence of death or readmission to the hospital within 90 days after the index admission. No serious adverse events were reported. Ristoplam in pre-symptomatic spinal muscular atrophy by Richard Finkel from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, Memphis, Tennessee, and co-authors. Ristoplam, an oral pre-messenger RNA splicing modifier, is an efficacious treatment for persons with symptomatic spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. The safety and efficacy of Ristoplam in pre-symptomatic disease are unclear. These investigators conducted an open-label study of daily oral Ristoplam in 26 infants who were 1 day, birth, to 42 days of age, with genetically diagnosed SMA, but without strongly suggestive clinical signs or symptoms. The infants with genetically diagnosed SMA who were treated with Ristoplam before the development of clinical signs or symptoms appeared to have better functional and survival outcomes at 12 and 24 months than untreated infants in natural history studies. Larger controlled studies with longer follow-up are needed to further understand the relative efficacy and safety of pre-symptomatic treatment of SMA with Ristoplam. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Charlotte Sumner from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Baltimore, notes that SMA is a genetic neuromuscular disease that causes degeneration of spinal and brainstem motor neurons. Weakness particularly affects proximal limb, respiratory, and pharyngeal skeletal muscles. In the therapy of SMA, further efforts to characterize the long-term outcomes of single treatments and effects of sequential or combined treatments are clearly needed. Many infants with SMA and 2 copies of survival motor neuron 2, or SMN2, variants continue to have clinical deficits despite neonatal treatment. This situation has raised the question of whether in utero treatment would be feasible, safe, and efficacious.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple: to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Metabolic Dysfunction-Associated Steatotic Liver Disease, a review article by Giovanni Targer from the University of Verona, Italy, and co-authors. Metabolic Dysfunction-Associated Steatotic Liver Disease, MASLD, is a multi-system disease that has become a public health problem worldwide. Metabolic dysfunction is key to the pathogenesis and consequences of MASLD. The clinical burden of MASLD consists mainly of liver-related disease and death, and high rates of fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, type 2 diabetes, and certain extrahepatic cancers, especially extrahepatic gastrointestinal cancers. There is a pressing need for drugs to treat MASLD and its more severe form, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, MASH. In March 2024, resmetirom, a liver-directed thyroid hormone receptor beta-selective agonist, was the first drug approved, though conditionally, by the Food and Drug Administration for treating adults with non-cirrhotic MASH and moderate to advanced fibrosis. Incretin-based drugs, especially semaglutide at a dose of 2.4 milligrams per week, and other metabolism-based pharmacotherapies are showing promise as therapeutic options not only for steatotic liver disease, but also for cardiovascular kidney metabolic complications that are strongly related to MASLD. A 28-year-old woman with respiratory failure and abnormal chest imaging. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by William Jansen and colleagues. A 28-year-old woman presented with progressive dyspnea and hypoxemia over several years, ultimately leading to respiratory failure and right heart failure. Initial evaluation showed diffuse centrolobular ground glass opacities and mildly enlarged lymph nodes, suggestive of hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Despite initial stability, she developed worsening exertional symptoms, hypoxemia, peripheral edema, and signs of pulmonary hypertension. Imaging later revealed septal thickening, pleural effusions, and dilated pulmonary arteries. Right heart catheterization confirmed severe precapillary pulmonary hypertension with a markedly elevated mean pulmonary arterial pressure and preserved wedge pressure. Her condition worsened with pulmonary vasodilator therapy, which raised concern for pulmonary veno-occlusive disease, PVOD, and pulmonary capillary hemangiomatosis, PCH. CT findings, centrolobular nodules, septal thickening, and mediastinal lymphadenopathy supported this diagnosis. Pathological examination of explanted lungs confirmed obliterative venopathy and capillary proliferation consistent with PVOD and PCH. The patient underwent urgent bilateral lung transplantation with good recovery. Dismantling public health infrastructure, endangering American lives. A perspective by Thomas Frieden from Resolve to Save Lives, New York. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and its ability to support clinicians, communities, and organizations is under assault. The current U.S. administration's plan to eliminate or transfer CDC programs that it inaccurately deems unnecessary, duplicative, or politicized would reverse decades of health progress, make Americans less safe, and increase healthcare costs. The CDC's stated mission is vital: to protect Americans from health threats, whatever their source or form. Current changes reflect a misunderstanding of the nature of modern health risks and will lower our guard against deadly dangers. The CDC is at particular risk because its role is poorly understood, is often misrepresented, and, though traditionally nonpartisan, has tepid congressional support. The agency tracks health trends, develops evidence-based guidelines and prevention strategies, and informs policy. It supports clinicians, the public, and domestic and international partners in implementing effective interventions with funding, staffing, laboratory services, field responses, technical assistance, and risk communication. The administration and Congress could choose precise improvements over demolition, strategic strengthening over systematic weakening, and evidence-based reform over policies that benefit harmful industries. Progress lost: the unraveling of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. A perspective by Jonathan Oberlander from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The 2010 enactment of the Affordable Care Act marked a milestone in U.S. healthcare policy. By expanding eligibility for Medicaid, regulating private insurance, and providing income-related subsidies to help people purchase coverage, the ACA greatly expanded access to health insurance. During the past 15 years, the size of the uninsured population in the United States fell to historic lows, and evidence accumulated that extending coverage saved many lives. Now, with passage of Congressional Republicans' 2025 Budget Reconciliation Act, which was supported by the Trump administration, another milestone has been reached. The new law represents the largest rollback of health insurance coverage in U.S. history. The budget bill adopts measures that make it harder to qualify for and stay enrolled in Medicaid or in subsidized coverage through the ACA's health insurance marketplaces. The resurgence of private law in American healthcare, a perspective by Christopher Robertson from Boston University School of Law, and Wendy Epstein from DePaul University College of Law, Chicago. Public law, the work of legislatures and administrative agencies, has long governed healthcare access, quality, and accountability in the United States. But recent deregulatory moves by the Trump administration have diminished its reach. Therefore, these authors expect private law to play an increasingly central role in the healthcare system. The role of private law mechanisms may be increased in several ways. First, contracts will increasingly serve as vehicles for governance. Second, the tort system, which covers medical malpractice, informed consent, and product liability claims, will most likely serve as a critical backstop for accountability and quality control in healthcare. The weakening of public regulators also elevates the role of corporate governance and fiduciary obligations. Finally, some of the most potent legal tools, hybrids of public and private law, may be affected. Public statutes with private rights of action, which enable private plaintiffs to pursue systemic claims. As public oversight diminishes, private law will assume a larger role in shaping the future of the healthcare system. However, reliance on private law comes with risks. The serendipitous dance between life and Deaf. A Perspective by Anudhari Zorigbattar from the University of Toronto, Canada. Transplantation is personal for Dr. Zorigbattar. As a surgical resident, she still feels the pain in her hands from packing ice around life-saving organs in the middle of the night. As a daughter, she still sees her father's joyful tears when the hospital called to say, "We have a liver for you." Dr. Zorigbattar's father had been unwell since before she was born. Over the years, they gradually became accustomed to her father's disoriented, glassy stares during episodes of encephalopathy and to sleepless nights spent in emergency departments. True to himself, her father was dancing outside the hospital just a week after his transplantation. Drains and central lines be damned. It felt like a miracle. But Dr. Zorigbattar would soon learn that miracles can be short-lived. She can't remember the doctor's exact words, but the gravity of her message was unmistakable. The graft was slowly failing, and her father would need to be listed again. The second transplant was a success. This time, though, their hope was cautious and their joy fragile. But her father was not just surviving anymore, he was living. Now, as a surgical resident, Dr. Zorigbattar has the privilege of caring for transplant patients and participating in organ retrievals near and far. As her father awaited an organ for his third transplantation, Dr. Zorigbattar retrieved a kidney from a fellow hockey fan, recognizing at a deep, personal level the value of his gift of life. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, the snowman sign in pituitary macroadenoma is shown. A 47-year-old woman presented with a one-month history of headaches and blurry vision. An MRI of the head showed an enlarged pituitary gland protruding from the cella turcica, known as the snowman sign. Another image shows ocular nathostomiasis. A man from rural India presented with redness and blurry vision in one eye. Examination was notable for panuveitis and a live worm in the posterior segment. The worm was removed in a pars plana vitrectomy, shown in a video at nejm.org. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.